Now it's time
the Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Gaza. We'll be talking about COP28 and the outcome in Dubai and whether or not that was positive or otherwise. And we'll be talking about the EU summit, which is still ongoing in Brussels. And of course, the big news yesterday was that both Ukraine and Moldova are given the green light to start an accession process to the EU, which could take several years, perhaps 5 years at a minimum for Ukraine, perhaps longer, with the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban walking out the door to allow the other members to vote for that accession. And then he blocked €50 billion in EU aid to Ukraine. The Belgian Prime Minister was asked about Orban's decision, and he had this to say.
You know, a decision of the Council is a decision that binds 27 countries. I think these are the rules of the game, and everyone knows that these are the rules of the game. If you decide and you agree to that decision, which is what the 27 in the room did, then you should not afterwards say, well, I have a different opinion on this. I mean, or if you are part of the decision, you agree with the decision, or afterwards you just have to keep your mouth shut. I should not have said that.
All right, so that was the Belgian Prime Minister. I'm joined by Billy Kelleher, Fianna Fáil MEP for Ireland South, by Marion Harkin, Independent TD for Sligo Leitrim, and Sinead O'Carroll, editor of thejournal.ie. Good morning and welcome. Billy Kelleher, what do you make of this?
Well, look, I mean, Viktor Orban is a political gurrier, being quite truthful when it comes to the issues of the European Union. He's been very truculent. He's been very awkward for a long period of time. And he's using his capacity with a veto to blackmail the European Union for funding.
Is it time to turf him out?
Well, I mean, I'd be very slow to turf them out because, I mean, you know, you always hope that come a general election in Hungary that the public could change their leadership. It happened in Poland, for example, quite recently. So I'm always reluctant to go down that particular road of turfing them out. But it does show the weakness of the unanimity decision.
But he's a Putin ally. I mean, he's in Putin's pocket. So is it right and proper that such a fifth columnist should be within the EU?
Well, I would much prefer if he wasn't, but he is. But the point I'm making is we can circumvent on certain areas. For example, sanctions. We have got 12 rounds of sanctions in place, even though primarily he objected on all occasions. But we eventually got him there. We've got Ukraine and Moldova to become accession states to the European Union. And the €50 billion is required next year. So there's still a little bit of time before Ukraine runs out of money in terms of funding its public services, and funding the state itself. So there is time. But yes, he is a Putin ally. He does undermine the concept of solidarity with Ukraine. And it makes us very difficult. But, you know, turfing him out because you don't like his political view means turfing Hungary out, which means turfing a lot of people that are very pro-European in Hungary.
Mm-hmm. Marion, you've walked those corridors in Brussels. What do you make of Orban's carry-on?
Well, of course, he continues as he started. And Billy is right. Orban is Orban and he has a certain political agenda. And you often find that what leaders say in Brussels is as much for the home audience as it is for a European audience. He wants to be seen as a strong man who can take on the Commission and take on the Council.
I mean, he has a concern, obviously, about grain from Ukraine flooding
the EU.
But
the
that would
one.
Be many years hence.
Yeah. And Poland also would have that concern. But look, this is about politics. And as Billy said, Orban is there now. He is the person representing Hungary. That may not be the case in 3 or 5 years' time. We saw what happened in Poland. Leaders come and go, but hopefully the European Union can find a way of continuing. Obviously, what he's trying to do is the EU have held back funding because of issues around the judiciary and press freedom. And
then they throw the bribe at him and he slaps their face.
Well, they gave him, I think, €10 billion because they said he had met the requirements. They say it's a technical decision. And I believe, that's the situation there, that he did actually reach the situation where the EU felt they could give him that. The other monies, of course, he's holding out for, and he wants to be seen as the strong man who can strong arm Europe into giving it to him.
Sinead.
In the early hours of the morning, he was conducting a power play. You know,
yeah,
he was absolutely conducting to make sure that every single country from there was from the domestic in his own country to us over here on the outskirts of Europe are talking about him. So, you know, he doesn't use his veto to allow the accession talks to start. But then, wham, middle of the morning, he makes sure that there's no announcement on the 50 billion and that everyone is talking about him and the power that he holds in the EU. So it's absolutely a power play to look at how strong I am and look at all these leaders of all the other countries have to wait for me to say yes before they can do anything. Mm. Now, Leo Varadkar going into the meeting this morning told reporters that, you know, they can use bilateral agreements to get around. So it doesn't have to be 27 countries agreeing. They can do other things. So, you know, there are other ways that Europe can get this 50 billion. But obviously, it's just easier if it's all 27.
The irony is, I remember being behind the Iron Curtain during the time of Gorbachev before the wall actually came down. And Hungary was the most liberal of all the Eastern European countries. I mean, and it was an escape valve. People could get through Hungary to the West. And how short their memories are of what it was like under the Soviet maw.
I think that's what Billy is saying as well. You can't punish the Hungarian people. Like, there is definitely obviously support for Viktor Orban. There's definitely, you know, he is talking to a domestic audience when he's doing this. But there are also a lot of pro-European and liberal people there. So you can't kind of tar the entire country with the Orban brush.
Yeah. But if you want to bring about political change, perhaps you have to use something of a big stick and say, look, guys, your future is not in Europe. Your future is with your pal Putin unless things change.
Unless, yeah, you use the democracy.
Mm. Yeah. But all right. Let's cross over to Dubai. And there was great hoo-ha about a deal finally being agreed, as it happens every time with the COPs, that they run over time in order to forge an agreement. But some of the headlines I've been seeing is, you know, a big win for big oil.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about whether this is now just a big trade fair for oil companies and then other people being allowed to come. So what they've decided eventually is a fair, fast, full, funded and feminist phase out of fossil fuels. So we've eventually got there. After 13 days of talks running over time, and really these are years over time. Like, it's great that we've eventually got to a point where we're talking about phasing out fossil fuels, but, you know, we're years too late. So how much of a win is it if we're years too late?
There's a lot of, you know, accelerating this, transitioning to that without a hard and fast.
Like, does this
decisions.
Make any bit of difference to one person listening to your radio today? Like, there's not one thing that we can say your life will be different because of this decision.
Marion?
Well, that's up to national governments to make it different. That's their role. And look, I agree with you, but you know what they say about the best time to plant a tree was when it should be planted, and the second best time is today. Mm. And we have to take COP28 as it is and move on from today. I just have listened to the commentary on it rather than maybe following the detail of it so much. And, you know, I listen carefully to Mary Robinson, what she says, because she is obviously into the detail of it.
And she was disappointed.
She was disappointed, but she also said it was historic because for the first time fossil fuels were mentioned, and that it does provide some kind of pathway. But what I liked about what she said was that the thing we need to do is to engage all of our citizens in this. Sometimes it's much too easy for people to say, oh, that's for the big corporations, that's for the oil companies, that's for somebody else to do. That governments really have to have a conversation with their citizens and find ways to engage ordinary people, communities in this whole area of climate change, give them ownership of it. And we haven't done that. We're finger pointing all the time. And I think now is a good time maybe to reset that.
That phrase I said, the fair, fast, full, fund and feminist phase out, that is from civil society groups. And it's so far away from what actually ended up being in the thing. So the civil society groups who are involved, who do want to include everyone, who don't want to point fingers at farmers, for instance. They want to include farmers, and you can see farmers doing brilliant things. And then instead of, you know, fossil fuel industry being pointed at, people try and distract and point at farmers. So I think that's the thing. Like, a lot of ordinary people want to do more, but they have to have leadership from governments and have to have leadership from industry.
And incentives.
Yeah.
Well, I'm amazed, being truthful, that they see it as a success, because if you even look at the president of COP, Sultan Al-Jaber, he spoke, and then some time later he announced that his company, which is an oil company, would be investing $150 billion in further oil exploration and development of the oil industry. So
I mean, that was a joke, that he was actually running the show.
Yeah, I think, look, the bottom line here is it is a bit of a sales pitch for the oil industry, and it's camouflaged in being an environmental COP, but in truth, it's not. The only thing that I think is interesting in all of this was the discussion around nuclear. And of course, that's a very unpalatable statement from COP from an Irish perspective, because we've banned nuclear power generation in Ireland, whereas they're now saying, and a lot of environmentalists are coming on board saying that, you know, nuclear is going to have to be an answer to the challenges facing us in terms of getting to carbon neutrality by 2050. And yeah, a lot of countries in Europe are beginning to discuss this again. So well, it's going to be an interesting
you've
one.
You've been talking about these small modular nuclear reactors, which would be factory built effectively and then assembled, and they're small in their scale. Also, the molten salt technology is now being tried in Canada, which automatically switches itself off. It cannot continue if something goes wrong. So nuclear has changed since the early days of nuclear plants, and yet we have this permanent bar.
Yeah, I think we're looking at nuclear from an Irish context. You know, first of all, nuclear wars between the USSR and United States of America years ago, and then we look at it through the tragic eyes of Chernobyl and more recently Fukushima. But in general, I mean, if you look across the entirety of the European Union, half are carbon-free electricity comes from nuclear power, half it. So without nuclear power, we haven't a hope in hell of meeting any of our targets that we've laid out in the Paris Agreement of 2015 or even the discussions around COP in Dubai. So
you're saying with all the wind and all the solar?
There's still no way we will get there. And I mean, if you look at most countries that have nuclear power in the European Union, they're now going to start investing in another round of upgrading the technologies. And some countries that previously had it banned are now looking at changing their policies on
Marian.
This. It's an issue for discussion. I don't think we should rule it out. We should base it on science rather than ideology.
Marian?
Yes, I mean, I think it's something that we need to discuss here. I think since we had, how long ago since we had that discussion about building a nuclear power?
Oh, well, Carnsore Point.
And it was lost at that
I think
time.
It started.
And I don't think there's ever been a discussion about it since. As you say, I've heard, I don't know the detail, but about these small units that are can be used. But the question I would have is, are they available? I mean, even if we did decide to go down that route, can we purchase them? Are they out there? Do we have the ancillary technology to put something like that in place, link it to the grid? You know, we have to look at the practicality of what we can do in the short term. You mentioned solar, Pat. One of the major issues there is, again, linking that to the grid. Now, we are making progress on it, but again, painfully slowly.
What tends to work a lot of the time is an incentive. Yeah. Remember the special savings accounts where you got an extra bonus from the government?
Yes.
And so many people took them up and they became nice little nest eggs. And yet we have a situation where Eamon Ryan is doing the business over in Dubai while his department is dropping the grants for solar panels on your roof, and the grants for EVs have gone down as well.
That makes no sense.
So you
of
preach
any kind.
Virtue on the one hand in Dubai, and then back home, where we know incentives do work, you reduce the incentives.
Incentives always work, but just one thing we have to be careful of is when we spend public money, that it gives the outcome that we want it to give.
In other words, not put more money in the installer's pocket.
Exactly. So that's what we have to be careful of. But the whole issue of solar panels, a lot of people are interested, will move with it, are doing it, but there's a lot of people who just can't afford to, and incentives for those people, I think, are hugely important.
Sinead, nuclear.
Yeah, I think the thing is, anytime we're talking about it, it's the fair transition. So I think a lot of people who have been able to put solar panels in place are people who can afford it. And those people then who are in buildings that need to be retrofitted, much more simple things need to be done to save energy and also to help them with the cost of living.
I mean, insulation.
It's a much more joined up thing. And it's on a bigger scale, it's the same thing that's happening in COP. So we did a much better this year at getting to a point where the loss and damage fund is actually, you know, it's created. The countries that are the least emitting countries and have seen the most amount of damage from climate change, you know, we need to be making sure as a world that we're helping those countries out. So it's the same on a much larger scale. The pledges started coming in at the start of COP, and then we're still at like 0.2% of the actual damage that has been caused you know, richer countries have only pledged 0.2% of the money that would actually count for that. So it's the same thing, the fair transition. It needs to look at the people who are most impacted and get to them first. And whether that is energy scientists saying nuclear is the way to go, or incentives for solar panels being incentivized for people who actually need them the most, yeah, you know, rather yeah. than...
But I mean, things we are not doing yet, although they're starting to talk about it. Every school roof should be solar powered. You know, it's they're public institutions.
Public buildings should be.
Maybe JP McManus's money to the GA should go for GA to have some.
One of the biggest problems is we just don't have capacity in terms of labour force. We've shortage of skill sets in all these key areas. We're trying to build more houses. We're trying to retrofit the historic or the older houses and then put in new systems of renewables. So there's a huge pressure point on our ability, just shortage of skill sets. And that's a key problem for the entire economy.
And I think one piece of the jigsaw that's missing in this country is the building of anaerobic digesters on a fairly small scale, you know, within some kind of small cooperative with farmers. I think there's 40 or 50 of them in Northern Ireland. We have a handful here. They're in Germany and France. They're everywhere to be found. It's a double win, and yet we're not moving with it. I mean, I know it's small scale, but you sometimes just have to take one step at a time, and we're not doing it.
All right. We'll talk about the war in Gaza, because the loss of human life and the people who are injured, almost 20,000 lives lost on the Palestinian side, and 50,000 plus actually injured, and that is terrible. But meantime, there's that other thing about what's going to happen, the reconstruction of Gaza, such as the incredible destruction. And I'm thinking, the amount of concrete that's going to have to be poured into Gaza, the amount of carbon that uses, the cost of a war in human terms, but also in carbon terms. It must be enormous. And no one's talking about it.
And even just what's happening with how that those wreckages have, like the scale of what's happening there, it's almost hard to keep talking about it this many months in. Like, the destruction of human life and the destruction of a city, and as you're saying, just the destruction of everything that we're meant to be doing as a world, and that, you know, leaders just aren't even thinking about how to change the situation there, never mind talking about it. It's hard to come on shows to this, and I've seen charities say that. I've seen places like MSF and Oxfam and the UN saying, like, we have lost words to try and keep attention on this, because it's just getting
because
worse.
Because it was a catastrophe 2 weeks ago. It's worse now.
Yeah. And we don't even
know what word do you use?
And we can't. I've been trying to get reports from Gaza for the journal, and I have a journalist in Gaza, and she just cannot get consistent enough internet to get any kind of communication out. So, like, a few WhatsApp voice notes here and there, and then quiet for 3 weeks, and then you're wondering, is she alive? Is she not alive? And so not even being able to get words from people living there, it's just so horrendous.
Yeah, and we run out of words. I've run out of words. As you say, it was a catastrophe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. What word do we use to describe it now? There isn't a word. And I suppose all we can do is, and I think the Irish government have led on this, and I'm proud of them for what they've done on it, because I think they took a step forward when it wasn't the most popular thing to do. I think now we have about 17 member states in the EU. You know more about this than me, Billy, but that are sort of agreeing with our position and the position that Spain and Belgium and I think was it Malta and Ireland started out with.
Billy?
So, yes.
I mean, look, the difficulty we have here is that we have 2.3 million people inside in a place the size of County Loud. And, you know, they're being shelled and bombed every minute of the day. I see last night that the Israelis attacked the Rafah crossing. So this is where 2.3 million people were told to go south to the Egyptian border. They're now bombing that particular part of Gaza. And where do we expect 2.3 million people to go? From what I can gather, and speaking to some people, I was meant to be there this weekend, but that didn't work out. You know, we now have a situation where we could have a communicable diseases right across the entirety of us. You know, drinking water is foul. We hear that they're bathing in raw sewage, effectively, across by the beaches of Gaza, because they have no ability to pump the sewage deeper out into the Mediterranean itself. So it really is a catastrophe in many ways. But the bottom line here is Israel cannot continue to bomb civilians. Like this is illegal under every.
But they will keep doing it until. Yes.
Will they ever pay a price?
It will take America to stand up. I mean, the only country, in my view, that can influence Israel at this stage is America. Unfortunately, the European Union can't do it as an entity because.
Yeah, but America is broken.
While you have Germany's and
you
and
have
others.
A man who is will. Admittedly, he said for the first day he'd be a despot, basically an autocrat, if he gets back. That's Trump. And you've got Biden, who seems to be paralysed.
Yeah, paralysed. Mm. Yeah, because
yes, it's very disturbing.
There's a very
for the whole
strong
thing.
Lobby there. And America, you said the European Union can't do it. You've got the same fissures in the US. And it is up to countries like Ireland.
That's what exactly,
yeah,
Marion.
To keep leading, to keep
but
pushing.
But I think we can do, obviously we can't do things unilaterally within the EU, but what we can do, we should do. And Leo Varadkar seems to be moving towards that.
Yeah.
But with each day, there's more debt.
When you talk about it in the European Union, though, the very minute you mention anything to do with Israel, straight away the countries that would have been, you know, Germany primarily, but others that were complicit in the Holocaust during the Second World War, they just freeze up. They just will not go there.
Yes,
they're carrying a burden of guilt and they just don't want to be seen to be anti-Semitic.
Right. So you asked, would Israel pay a price? They absolutely will. They'll pay it in their own country because they'll carry the guilt of it, but they'll also pay it within the wider area in which they live. They were making real progress before this, and this is a generational thing. It's sad beyond belief.
All right, we have to leave it there. My thanks to Marion Harkin, independent GD for Sligo Leitrim, Billy Keller, Fianna Fáil, MVP for Ireland South, and Sinead O'Carroll, who's editor of the journal That.ie.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.